how do you survive?
Yeah.
How do you actually survive this?
I really thought that I'm not going to make it because I just couldn't get air into my lungs.
Through the relaxations of these social distancing measures, certainly we were seeing a rise in the number of cumulative cases.
It is the end of week 5 of SA's national lockdown and officially the end of 35 days of level 5 of the lockdown.
Our people need to eat. They need to earn a living. Companies need to be able to produce and to trade. They need to generate revenue and keep their employees in employment. We have accordingly decided that beyond Thursday, the 30th of April, we should begin a gradual and phased recovery of economic activity.
That's right. SA is now on lockdown level 4. But please keep in mind that this does not mean that the country is out of lockdown. A number of restrictions do still apply, and for the health and safety of our society, we plead with you to adhere to the latest restrictions. In the short podcast series, we follow Sunday Times reporter Alex Patrick and senior reporter Graham Hoskin as they track, record, and reflect on the real events and people that make up SA's biggest COVID-19 news stories. For Boots on the Ground, behind SA's national lockdown, I am Zamalu Thuli. Moving into level 4 has been marked by a palatable shift in mood for a lot of us, and our journalists are not excluded. In a short span of time, many South Africans have been made to come to terms with the fragility of their own stability and the trauma of watching others struggle. In today's episode of Boots on the Ground, behind SA's national lockdown, we speak to a COVID-19 survivor about overcoming the virus, and Graham and Alex contemplate the scenes they've been faced with since the beginning of the national lockdown. Pia Buerta from Mpumalanga went to a function on the 14th of March, where he unknowingly contracted COVID-19 from another guest. In the week that followed, Pierre began to feel very ill. Graham spoke to Pierre about the experience and how desperate he was to protect his family from the infection.
Talk me through like how you got infected and when you realized that you were infected and your experience.
During that week, I lost I couldn't taste any food. Everything just tasted the same. And towards that weekend, I got a bit of a high fever and I started battling to breathe. And during that weekend, the people from the function from the previous weekend phoned me and they said to me that one of the ladies that was at our table tested positive for the COVID-19. Then I thought, well, I've got high fever and I'm battling to breathe. But at that stage, I didn't realize that I was also positive. And that Sunday night, my fever really got very high, and the next morning, I didn't feel well. At that stage, I really thought that I'm going to test positive, and when I got home, I got tested, and the result the next morning was that I was positive.
And when you got that result, I mean, what went through your mind? What did you think, and what did you do?
Well, it's a difficult thing, because first of all, you've got to protect your family, because at that stage, my son moved in to our house as well, because then the lockdown started, and he said he's going to stay with us, because he's staying all on his own in a flat. And the first thing that we realized that we have to separate, and the only possible way was for me to go out of the house. And fortunately, my caravan was still standing outside, and we decided that my family is going to stay in the house and that we will have no contact at all. For 18 days, I stayed in the caravan and my family in the house.
For Pierre, his family caravan was all that stood between the virus and his wife and son. In a sense, Pierre is lucky. many South Africans would not have a method of keeping their loved ones healthy if they were to become ill. But being alone, sick, and scared still took a toll on Pierre, particularly on the night the virus peaked, and he wasn't sure if he would be able to walk out of the caravan again.
What was that like? I mean, what was your, that first day that you isolated yourself? I mean, what did you...
The first day was a bit mixed up because I was still organizing myself, and the next morning I really got sick, and that weekend I was really sick. I didn't even get up. I just stayed on the bed, and I was really battling to breathe. I didn't have any power to move around. It was terrible. At some stage, I thought I'm not going to make it. That one night, I cannot remember which night it was, but it was one of the nights over the weekend that I really thought that I'm not going to make it because I just couldn't get air into my lungs. But it was terrible. Especially that night, I can see my family in the house through the windows, and they were making food. And every night they bring out a plate and they put it outside on a table on a paper plate. And then I go and collect it once they move back into the house. And that was a terrible, very much terrible, to be on your own. That after about 6 at night, from 6 until 10, 11 when you go to bed, that was the most terrible time of the day. Because at that stage you can see your family inside, but you can't communicate. Sometimes I walk closer to the window and we had a bit of a chat through the closed window, but it was not nice. It was that I think after that weekend when I was terribly sick, the main thing was to keep your head right. It's to stay positive, not to get negative, it was the toughest to keep positive.
And I mean, how long were you in isolation for, and what's it been like coming out? I mean, and seeing people around and seeing what other people are doing.
I think to get out of isolation, out of the caravan after 18 days was like a guy. I don't know what it's like to be in jail, but I think it's more or less the same feeling to get out of jail. But you get that little bit of freedom and you can get in contact with your family and sit around the table and have a meal with them. That was like heaven.
He says he was reassured that other people he encountered before being diagnosed were safe because his local health services did an incredibly thorough job.
And, I mean, were you worried about having infected others? I mean, other than your family and that?
Not really, because once I got home, I was almost immediately into isolation. I did give the... we were four caravans that camped together on the South Coast. I did give the names of the other people, and they were immediately contacted by the medical personnel from our local hospital, and they all were tested, and they were also checked every day. The temperatures were checked, as well as my family, and they were as far away as Verkeer, the flight near Bloemfontein, and luckily nobody else got infected with the virus.
Sure. And in terms of, like, while you were at home, did the health department or health officials or health laboratory officials come around to decontaminate your house and caravan?
What happened? Yes. They contacted me on sometimes on a daily basis, and our doctor in town also contacted me every day. She gave me a lot of support. The people from the hospital, I cannot remember which day they came out, but they came out with completely, looks like space age men, and with sprayers on their back, and they disinfected my whole caravan on the inside and the outside, and they went also into the house and they sprayed the whole house with the alcohol based sanitizer.
It does, however, raise the question if this is the level of disinfectant and monitoring that is needed for every confirmed case of COVID-19 in order to prevent further spread. How will medical personnel handle the spike in cases that have been predicted? After a quick break, we speak to a mathematician who has crunched the numbers.
Time Select is your ticket to news without the noise, a daily digital edition of news, business, lifestyle, sport, and more. It's news you can trust anytime, anywhere. We know that's important now more than ever, and that's why we're offering a 60-day subscription to Time Select for just 60 Rand. Go to select.timeslive.co.za/buy to sign up for this great deal.
And now, back to the story. Professor Farai Nyabata, an advanced researcher in mathematical epidemiology, has been tracking the outbreak and the impact lockdown has had on the rate of infections in South Africa.
So my name is Professor Farai Nyabata, and I'm the deputy head of department of the Department of Mathematics and Applied Mathematics at the University of Johannesburg. I actually specialize in applying mathematics to infectious diseases. And in this particular case, I actually do infectious diseases modeling.
The professor and his co-workers have developed a model which indicates that relaxing social distancing by 2% is expected to result in a 23% rise in the numbers of cumulative cases, a troubling figure moving into level 4 of the national lockdown. The professor explains some of their findings.
So we were actually interested in this aspect of social distancing, that, you know, mathematically social distancing is not actually a preventative measure, but rather a way of prolonging a process so that at least the government can actually be ready. So what we actually discovered was that through the relaxations of these social distancing measures, certainly we were seeing a rise in the number of cumulative cases. And our model actually was actually spot on in predicting the number of cumulative cases up to today. We were actually playing around with a what-if scenario, like what if you increase the social distancing by 2%, or what if you relax social distancing by 2%, what will be the impact on the number of cases? And so we realized that if you relax social distancing by about 2%, then the numbers would certainly jump up by around 23%. What social distancing does is it simply, reduces the size of the number of people that are going to be infected. But in essence, it's not like it is going to stop the epidemic from going on. So it prolongs the epidemic over a very long period of time. But at the same time, it also gives you time to prepare. And at the same time, you don't have so many people that will actually be frequenting our healthcare system, or people that will actually overwhelm our healthcare system. So in my own opinion, I would with the new things that are, with the new regulations that are coming up, you know, there's this trade-off between certainly survival and then the disease. Because in the end, you have people that are actually struggling at the present moment, but at the same time, we have got to control the disease. That's why you probably have seen that now it will be mandatory to wear masks and so on, as to curb the spread of the disease. You know, our expectation is that now we will actually have an increase in the number of cases. But there's also one good thing about it, that now the government seems to be prepared to deal with the new cases that would actually arise. So we don't have as yet what, in terms of percentages, what this would actually give rise to. But certainly, now that people are going back to the industry, and we will have, again, an increase in our public transport sector. Certainly, our social distancing is now going to actually be reduced significantly. And in this case, we will certainly see a rise in the numbers. This is my prediction from a mathematical point of view.
Professor Nyabadza explains that UJ will continue to model the local numbers of infection in order to help us better understand what each level of the lockdown will realistically do for the country. We are going to take another short break, and when we get back, Graham and Alex chat to each other about the things that they have seen and how they are handling the mental strain of reporting on the lockdown.
Time Select is your ticket to news without the noise, a daily digital edition of news, business, lifestyle, sport, and more. It's news you can trust anytime, anywhere. We know that's important now more than ever, and that's why we're offering a 60-day subscription to Time Select for just 60 Rand. Go to select.timeslive.co.za/buy to sign up for this great deal.
Let's return to the story.
How's it, my friend?
Okay, how are you?
I'm feeling a bit weird, eh?
What's wrong?
No, relax. I'm
don't
just
worry
not
about you.
No, ugh, the fuck. I had an emotional week this week. I think it's also a lack of sleep. I've been going to bed like super late.
Yeah.
So, it hasn't helped.
Yeah.
Alex and Graham agreed to undertake this podcast just before the lockdown commenced. And while they are very used to reporting on some of the most awful elements of humanity, reporting on a story with no clear wrongdoer is complicated. There seems to be no one to hold accountable for the suffering that they are witnessing. Like all of us, they are experiencing the lockdown. It is happening to them and their loved ones. But they are also witnessing the most heart-wrenching struggles, and like all of us, they are powerless to stop it. Alex and Graham's frustration is not uncommon in South Africa at the moment. Without a clear right or wrong path in this situation, the balancing of health and safety versus freedom of movement and livelihoods is becoming a serious bone of contention.
A lot of what's kind of on my mind is like the kind of human impact of everything. And I mean, I'm doing 5 a.m. wake ups and then, you know, like 1 o'clock bedtime. And just feeling really, really kind of, it's almost like a depression that kind of sinks in. I've been thinking about, you know, a lot of my friends have lost jobs, and a lot of, you know, with a lot of pay cuts. A lot of retrenchments, and and I've just been and then also you go out onto the field and you're seeing people even in like even worse positions than you. On when was it, Thursday, I was in Elias Motsoaledi again, and also, you know, doing a story on the SASSA grants and how people now have to wait 6 more days, and people were showing the inside of their cupboards and their fridges, and I mean, there's nothing, you know. One woman has like 2 cups of maize meal for 7 family members, and that's going to have to last for 6 days, you know.
No, it's nuts. For me, it was like, it's survivability, yeah. That's what it is for me. I mean, it's like, just how the hell do people survive?
I have no idea.
You know, I'm feeling a little bit like spooked in that.
Yeah.
You know, and just, I haven't been feeling well, but I mean, it's not, I know it's not anything serious, but I mean, things start, you know, going through your mind, and you start like, what if, you know, and then I've like also just been feeling like this massive sense of guilt.
Really?
Yeah, it's just like this like, you know, I don't know, I was chatting to somebody and say, oh, maybe it's survivor's guilt. And I'm like, well, survivor's guilt is like when you die.
Yeah.
Also, you're in like a near-death
experience.
And they were saying, yeah, but you could very well have survivor's guilt because you see people who don't have anything.
I think it is. Yeah. I think it is survivor's guilt, and I've, you know, myself, I've been very weepy, you know.
Yeah.
Coming back from especially the townships.
Yeah, so I mean, I was up on the border, and you see people's desperation. I mean, you can really, really see it. And like you say, you go to the townships and informal sectors, and you see people's desperation. And then you come home, and it's like you're warm, you're safe, you can cook a meal, you know. And it's like, then I'm just like, fuck yourself, at you. Yeah, it's like, stop being such a selfish twat.
Yeah. Mark was saying to me, because I've been also, we took food to some of the families we support.
Yeah.
And it like wasn't enough, you know. I felt that guilt, and Mark kept saying to me, you know, it's probably more groceries than they've seen, but it's just, you know, you look at their two children, and you just wonder, like, what is the future here?
Yeah, I mean, like there's peace in the grant, right? So I was interviewing SASA's CEO, and it's like, okay, so why are they, what was the rationale for the delaying in the grants? And she says, no, it's to protect people. So I'm like, okay, but how are you protecting people?
Yeah.
So she's like, well, there's going to be a mad rush for the shops at the end of the month because everybody gets paid. I'm like, okay, no, I understand that. I get that.
Yeah.
But, can't you bring it forward, the payment dates for the elderly and the disabled and the kids, etc.? And it's like, no, because government would then have to borrow, and we've already borrow the money because they only get the government only gets its revenue from us taxpayers at the end of the month. So then they've got to borrow money, and then under the lockdown it's and the junk status, it's so much more difficult and so much more interest, etc.
So is that why they moved it back?
That's apparently why they moved it back.
Oh,
I was like, really? You know, you've got 18 million grants you need to pay out.
Yeah.
You know, it's 15 billion odd rand or 20 billion rand.
Yeah.
You know, the thing of moving it by 1 week, it means that if you get a grant of 440 odd rand for a kid, that means for a week you're not going to have that. You budget that money for a month.
Exactly.
But now you've got 5 weeks and an extra week. And if, let's say, I was chatting to a couple of NGOs and they were saying, you know, on average, a caregiver looks after two kids, a minimum of two kids. And if you get a grant, you don't get a food, you don't get a government pass. So now you've got no money to go buy food.
Yeah.
And you've got no food. And you're not allowed to access a food grant. I'm just like, this is the most screwed up system ever.
Screwed up. And also chatting to people who do rely on grants, I mean, to try and get them to talk about it, because they also, they don't want to talk about it because they do rely on the food drop-offs as well.
Yeah.
And you can say, you know, but you've got three child grants. But, I mean, 445 rand a month. And it doesn't feed kids. It feeds the family.
Yeah. I was talking to her about the COVID grant, and that's 350 rand. I said, how did you get to that amount? No, there's only a limited amount of money. They estimate that by the end of September there will be 7 million people on the grant. So I'm like, okay, but now what happens in a household? No, well, if you're homeless, you can't access the grant. If you are in a government shelter, you can't access the grant. If you're on a government grant, you can't access the grant. If you're on UIF, this NSFAS, any government assistance, you can't access a grant. And then, so I said, okay, well, if I'm living in a house, my brother and I and my sister are unemployed. Can we all access the grant? No. Only two people in the house can access the grant.
I thought it was per person.
No, it's two per household.
Jeez.
I'm like, okay, but now how do people access the grant? She says, no, it's electronic. So I'm like, okay, but like, how? She says, no. I said, do you need a smartphone? She says, no, you don't. You can do it via normal WhatsApp or SMS. I'm like, okay. But when you tested the system last week, it crashed. Yeah, they had 100,000 applications last weekend for this thing.
Jeez.
They're expecting 500,000 at the end of this month. Wow. I'm like,
how's your system going to cope with it? No, we've sorted everything out. Everything's fine.
Because I mean, speaking to people on the ground who do not have smartphones, do not have data, don't have access to computers. Timbeka, one of the women that I spoke to, she's 26. She was like, even when you do get grants, it's gonna take like months to process them. The same with UIF. I mean, it's a lot of people who applied for UIF at the beginning of the 5 months, 5 weeks of lockdown, still haven't received any word.
And I was chatting to like Black Sash and UCT Children's Institute, and they're saying, you know, we know the efforts of government, but it's like last minute. And it's too little too late.
Absolutely.
They should have done this stuff months ago.
Yeah. And preempted what's going
to happen. Yeah. I mean, you know something's going to come. I mean, and like now, it's just rush around. I mean, I said to her, how many people are you planning on processing? Then we expect 500,000. I'm like, your system crashed on 100,000. You're now going to process 500,000 people. I'm like, all your SASSA officers are closed. No, we're going to bring them back up a lot. I'm like, okay, how many people? No, we're going to only have 30% capacity. Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's going to work.
We're promising all this extra money. A lot of people thought, though, that the extra kind of top-up money is for the other grants was like per child, but it's one per household.
No, I mean,
it comes, 6 months later, and they're like, cool, we're going to stop paying you now.
Yeah, no, it suddenly ends. Then you're back in shit street again.
Yeah.
When you get, so each kid now this month gets 300 rand added to their child support grant, which is fine. You know, well, I mean, it's not fine. They need a lot more. I mean, the poverty line is 1,200. These poor kids are getting, like, this month, 700 and something rand.
Absolutely.
And then next month, that money gets taken away. And then their caregiver gets 500 bucks.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you're trying to rob Peter to pay Paul and steal from Susie and Sandra and everybody else. It's just like, what the fuck? I'm like, how do you expect people in this country to survive?
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know how people survive.
I have no idea. And it's not like, oh, we're on level 4 now, everything goes back to normal.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, like we're still in lockdown. Those jobs are still not available, and if we do go on to like level 1 or we go back to normal, like what's left for everyone?
There's like bugger all left.
Nothing.
There's nothing. I mean, it's like we don't know how long level 4 is going to be.
Yeah.
Be on for.
Yeah.
You know, it could be months. It could be another 3 months. I mean, they're talking about this thing going on until for 6 months, but.
Yeah.
Then it's level 3, then level 2, then hopefully level 1, and then hopefully we back to bloody normal. But I mean, it's just,
who knows? We could even digress. We could go backwards.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. It's just I don't know. For me, this week is just like, how do you survive?
Yeah.
How do you actually survive this?
The question that kept coming up in their conversation was, how are people meant to survive? A question a lot of us are wrestling with at the moment. It seems possible that a lot of South Africans who emerge on the other side of this with their health and income intact may, like Graham and Alex, experience a form of survivor's guilt, as they put it. With many restrictions in place, Level 4 feels like a hollow victory for those following the new regulations. For others, it is easier to pretend that Level 4 is the end of the lockdown altogether. The process has been and continues to be hard for many South Africans. Confirmed cases and related deaths are mounting, but we remain hopeful that the efforts taken by the government, essential services, and communities will make a difference. For Boots on the Ground, behind SA's national lockdown, a production of Multimedia Live. I am Zamalutuli.
You are listening to Boots on the Ground, behind SA's national lockdown. Boots on the Ground is a short podcast series documenting South Africa's national lockdown as a result of the outbreak of COVID-19. Boots on the Ground is a true piece of mobile journalism. All interviews, voices, and sound effects have been gathered using nothing but smartphones. Boots on the Ground is a production of Multimedia Live, a division of Arena Holdings. Narration done by Samad Lutuli. Audio gathered by Graham Hoskin and Alex Patrick. Sound design and editing by Paige Muller. Production by Multimedia Head Scott Peter Smith. To catch the next episode of Boots on the Ground for free, please subscribe to the podcast on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.